Some people get what they pay for. Other people get what they deserve. But everybody gets what's coming to them. And what goes around comes around. The pagans call it karma. The practical call it common sense. But to the Christian, these are just a few examples of the much observed truth that God has ordered His world in such a way so as to be predictable. Okay? We have been given a limited ability to predict the future. It's what makes life livable. It's what makes it possible to be reasonable for us. But despite this gift from God, many of us still seem to think that we can alter the way that things have been created, that we can uniquely have a special control of our destiny, that we can somehow work in one way and get different results, that we can sow one thing and reap a different thing. The nation of Israel, in the book of Hosea, has been making this same mistake. They think that they can play both sides. They think that history doesn't work for them like it does for everyone else. And we will find today that just like the consumer who gets what they pay for and the criminal, I suppose, who gets what they deserve, Israel is going to reap what they sow in order to correct God's child, in order to lead them back to the place that they are to be. So we're going to be in chapter 6 today. This is a broad section. It's a big section. It's going to cover from chapter 6 all the way to the beginning of chapter 11. We're stopping at the end of chapter 10 today. I'm going to save chapter 11. I have something special for y'all next week with that I think you'll appreciate. But today we'll be in Hosea chapter 6. We're going to pick up right where we left off. So if you will, go ahead and meet me. Hosea chapter 6. The message of Hosea of this book is simple. We keep repeating it because it's the one thing that I want to make sure we got down pat by the time we get to the end of this book. And that's that unfaithful Israel is going to return to the bondage of Egypt in Assyria. That is until their hearts return to the Lord and they seek Him and David their king. At that point, their faithful God will restore them. Okay, so unfaithful Israel going back to the bondage of Egypt, but their faithful God will restore them when their hearts return to Him and begin to seek Him and David their king. That's the message. Opening three chapters we looked at, we saw God's relationship to Israel depicted through the lens of Hosea's marriage to his unfaithful wife, Gomer. As a result, what we looked at last week in chapter 4 through 6, God takes His unfaithful wife to court. It's a divorce court. He has a case against her. There is no faithfulness, no chesed, no knowledge of God in the land. There's just lawlessness. The people are getting fat off their sin. The priests have Sodom and Gomorrah going on in the land. The princes, they've sold themselves out to the nations. So God takes them to court. He lays His case out against them. And then now in chapter 6, starting in verse 4, Hosea is going to turn from this imagery of a husband and a wife to the imagery of a father with his children, a father and his son. So pick it up with me. Hosea chapter 6, verse 4. What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? For your loyalty is like a morning cloud, and like the dew which goes away early. Therefore, I've hewn them to pieces by the prophets. I've slain them by the words of my mouth. And the judgments on y'all are like the light that goes forth. For I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. But like Adam, they have transgressed the covenant. There they have dealt treacherously against me. As you recall, in the south, the kings come from the dynasty that stems from one tribe. They're part of one dynasty from one tribe. It is the Davidic dynasty, the Davidic kings, that come from the line of Judah. Not so in the north. Okay, it is a Game of Thrones up in the north. It is a free-for-all up in the north. You might get a few kings in a row, but it never seems to last. You know, eventually someone's going to come and assassinate them or overthrow them, and now you've got a new group of guys setting up shop in the king's house. Now, the first king in the north, the one that the Lord established when he took away the tribes, when he split the kingdom and took 10 tribes away from Solomon, came from the tribe of Ephraim. His name was Jeroboam. He's the one that set up these golden calves, this false worship system that just sent Israel on a bad trajectory from the start. But because of that, the kings in the north here are referred to as Ephraim. Okay, so here God is looking at the kings in the north and the kings in the south, and he's looking at them like they're his kids, and he's saying, what am I going to do with y'all? Ephraim, Judah, you knuckleheads, what am I going to do with you? Y'all, verse 1, you may recall the call to return to the Lord. And they do. They do return to him, knowing that, verse 3, his going forth then is as certain as the dawn, knowing that God will come down to them and rain down his chesed on them. But he says, verse 4, y'all's chesed is like the morning cloud. It's like the dew, that your loyalty, it's rendered in the NASB. NIV might say mercy. It is that sacrificial love, that character of God. Y'all's chesed, it's just like the morning cloud, like the dew that goes away. You guys come to me with talk of remorse and talk of repentance on Sunday, and then Monday it's the same old thing. You go right back to the same old things y'all were doing. You're all talk, but no chesed. Therefore, he says, verse 5, I've been beating you from head to toe with the prophets. I've been sending my word of judgment against you. And since you know that my going forth is as certain as the dawn, you better believe that the judgment on y'all, verse 5, it's like the light that goes forth. It's coming. I will respond to you based on how you are responding to me. It's kind of like, remember when Joshua is leading the people into the land and he comes across the angel of the Lord and he's asking, hey, whose team are you on? You on our team? Are you on their team in the land? He says, neither. I'm on God's team. The question is, whose team are you on? Same kind of situation. How are you responding to God is going to determine how he responds to you. His judgment's like the light that's going forth upon them. Why? Because despite everything we find, Israel does not know the Lord. There is no knowledge of God in the land. That's how the prophet is saying, verse 3, let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. That doesn't mean that they're not doing stuff. It doesn't mean that they aren't religious. It doesn't mean that they aren't spiritual. They are. They are very religious. They are a very spiritual people. Last week we mentioned that Amos was, there's three prophets that go to the north: Jonah, Amos, and Hosea. And Amos is written to the same people around the same time who are dealing with the same stuff in the same place. Listen to what he says. This is Amos chapter 4, verse 4. Enter Bethel and transgress. In Gilgal, multiply transgressing. Bring your sacrifices every morning, your tithes every 3 days. Offer a thank offering also from that which is leavened, and proclaim free will offerings. Make them known, for so you love to do, you sons of Israel, declares the Lord. They sacrifice every morning, offer tithes twice a week, they're given thank offerings and free will offerings, and they're going around and bragging about it and telling everybody what they did. You know, they're doing stuff. They're doing a lot. They're very spiritual people. They're very religious people. But he's saying the problem is your spirituality is not accompanied by knowledge. You don't know me. It's been my experience that it is often the case, you know, oftentimes, the people who present themselves as the most spiritual people are often also the most biblically illiterate people. Their spirituality, their knowledge of God, is based off their experience or their idea of their experience. They have no knowledge. They actually reject knowledge based, you know, on their experience. If you try to talk to them about the Lord, you say, well, you know, I don't know if the Lord is okay with this or that. They'll say, well, you know, I've had this experience about this. They use omens or they use whatever to determine what's right for them. They have no knowledge. I recently started reading a book called Intimacy with God by Dr. John Hanna. He had this to say, if our goal is to live in such a manner that conforms to the character of God, to the object of our delight and affection, we must know Him. If we are ignorant of the ways and values of the one we seek to please, we will find ourselves stumbling about in all allegorical darkness to please Him. This point is what we might call the importance of the mental. You know, at the very basic realm of interpersonal communication, how can we appropriately communicate and have wholesome relationship with a person we do not know? You know, whether it be a parent, mate, child, a friend, it requires learning. It's also true of walking with the Lord. This means that we must get to know Him as the singularly supreme source of the knowledge of Himself. Not merely about Him, what we might call secondary experience, but Him. We must become acquainted with the Bible because in it, God has supremely revealed Himself. It is the self-revelation of Himself. He is the transcendent God. He's not part of creation. He's apart from it. The only way we can know about Him is if He self-reveals Himself to us. And that's our problem. We have a Bible, but it's just for show. It's like an accessory that we take with us to church once a week, along with our watch or our purse and our other accessories. But we don't know what's in it. That's Israel's problem. Okay? In chapter 8, verse 12, he will say, though I wrote for him, Israel, 10,000 precepts of my law, they're regarded as a strange thing. They have the law, but they have no idea what it actually encompasses. They don't read it. They don't know it. They don't know God. They think that He's like the pagan gods that want the stuff. They think that He wants the sacrifices. He wants the offerings. He doesn't. He doesn't want the sacrifices or the offerings. It says he delights instead in chesed and knowledge of God. He cares about character and relationship, loyalty or mercy, the sacrificial mercy and the relationship with Him. That's what he cares about. Not the stuff. Not the bulls and goats that you come and cut up because you have rebelled against Him. He's not excited about that. That's a repair. That's a covenant thing you do to repair because of the breach in actual relationship. So they don't know Him. They don't understand. This is a lot like we've talked the other week about the lost son. All right, the story about the lost son isn't about the lost son. It's about God's character, what He desires, what he is interested in. He's interested in returning sinners. And the elder son, the one that the story is directed at, his problem is that he doesn't know the father. He says, when the son returns, he's upset. He says, Father, I never left. I've been here the whole time, and you've never given me the fatted calf, cut it up for me and my friends. You've never done this for me. This son of yours who's rebelled against you comes back, and now you're slaughtering things and throwing a party for him. He hates the father's character. He disagrees with it. He thinks that it's all about the stuff. And this son has ruined your stuff. Okay? And you gave him the inheritance and he squandered it. I've been wise with it, so I should be rewarded. He doesn't understand what the father values. Here, Israel does not understand what the father values. They think he values the stuff. Same thing. This character idea that the law was supposed to reveal a God of mercy, a God of sacrifice, a God of loyal love. This is not a New Testament innovation. This is not something that Jesus brings to the scene on the Gospels and kind of, you know, flips the script on the Pharisees. He doesn't do that. He's not flipping the script. He's saying, y'all aren't teaching the law. You're not following the law. That's the problem. Let me instruct y'all and help you read it, since you're obviously not. This is something that has always been this way. In fact, it's been this way. This has been God's revelation from the beginning, which is why he's going to go back to the beginning in verse 7. Israel, as God's national representative, has failed to represent God's character, just like verse 7, Adam. Just like Adam, they've transgressed the covenant. Just like Adam, his individual representative, failed in the garden, Israel, his national representative, has failed to represent him. Now, when Adam transgressed, what was the punishment for his sin? How did God respond?
Death.
The punishment for sin is death. That's the problem in the story. That's our problem. What is the solution to the problem? What's the solution provided to remedy death for Adam? For us? Resurrection. Resurrection. Now, Israel, the national representative, what do you suppose will be the judgment for their sin? Listen to this. This is chapter 13, verse 1. When Ephraim spoke, there was trembling. He exalted himself in Israel, but through Baal, he did wrong and he died. The punishment for Israel's national sin will be national death. What do you suppose is the solution for national Israel? Resurrection. Chapter 6, verse 2. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day that we may live before him. And we're not talking about best life now. This is live like eternal life. This is, Ezekiel will look at this. This is dry bones. The nation's coming back. He will resurrect. So he takes his unfaithful wife, and as we saw in previous weeks, he's going to condemn her according to the law as an adulteress. He will kill her, and then he'll bring her back. But this time, remember, he's going to put his character in it. He will betroth her with his keset. The dowry price is going to be him putting his character, his law, on her heart. So this is never going to happen again. So Israel has rebelled. Israel's going to die. Israel will be resurrected. But first they have to know God. They got to come to know him. They got to know him. Look at the second half of verse 11. He says, when I restore the fortunes of my people, when I would heal Israel, the iniquity of Ephraim is uncovered, and the evil deeds of Samaria, for they deal falsely. The thief enters in, the bandit raid outside. They don't consider in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their deeds are all around them. They're before my face. With their wickedness, they make the king glad, and the princes with their lies. He says, you know, I would heal y'all. I would stop bringing down the curses. But I can't even get to that. And because y'all are so busy, the wickedness has become so prolific. You don't even try to hide it anymore. And even if, you know, you're not putting up a front. And even if you wanted to, you couldn't, because it's so widespread. You do it right in front of my face. And the king, the supreme court of the land, the king is the highest judge. It's his job to judge evil, to lead the people into righteousness. He says the supreme court of the land, he approves of it. It makes him glad. He's excited when Roe versus Wade is upheld. He's excited whenever LGBTQ is approved of and becomes commonplace. When wickedness is prolific in the land, the king and the princes, they're excited when it's normalized. Israel was supposed to be a distinct people, a separate people, a holy nation, a light to the Gentiles. But they don't want to be that. They look around and see what everybody else is doing and say, we want to be like them. We want to have it like they have it. We want to do it like they do it. We want to be like everybody else. We want to look like them. We want to act like them. One of my profs, I was thinking about this in regards to my kids. You know, the way the education system is going, if you're sending somebody to public school, you know, here you go, Satan, indoctrinate my kids, is basically what you're saying. So my wife and I, for our end, we would like to do homeschool, but whether or not that will be an option is yet to be seen. But I was thinking about this. He says when his kids were growing up, I know one of them now, they're going through with me. When his kids were growing up, whenever they'd go, he was telling us he would tell them before they go to school that day, remember, you're different. You're going to school. You know, you're going in with all these friends, all these folks that, you know, come from here and come from there. And when you look around and see what they're doing and see what they're saying and what they're thinking, you need to remember, you are different. You're different. Okay? You're a child of God. You know the Lord. You're different. You're not like them, so don't try to be like them. You don't have to try to be like them. You weren't made to be like them. You're different. That was what Israel was supposed to do. They're not doing it. Instead, chapter 7, verse 8, Ephraim mixes himself with the nations. Ephraim has become a cake not turned. Strangers devour his strength, yet he doesn't know it. Gray hairs are sprinkled on him, yet he doesn't know it. Though the pride of Israel testifies against him, yet they have not returned to the Lord their God, nor have they sought him for all this. See, Israel wants to be admired by the nations. They want to be seen as powerful. They want to be seen as prosperous. But the problem is God is destroying their economy. Okay, he's got the place on lockdown. No water, no rain, no crops. Everything's going by the wayside. Animals are dying, crops are dying, people are getting skinny. They're not so prosperous anymore. They're not so powerful anymore. They're not so. And they're going to the nations for help. And they're losing out on their international deals. You know, we might say China is eating their lunch. They're getting in trouble in these deals. The strangers are devouring their strength and they don't know it. They're becoming feeble and they're not recognizing it because it doesn't happen in a day. This is something that happens over a course of time. Slowly, over time, they're becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. And yet, they have not returned to the Lord. See, their pride is testifying against them because it's hard to ask for help. If you're a proud person and you need help on something, that's a tough thing to, you know, you have to humble yourself. And your pride, of course, is beating you up in the background along the way when you walk in and you say, you know, I need a little help here. He says, that's what's happening to the nation. You who want to be seen this way, you know, as you're having to humble yourself and go ask for a handout, you should just return to the Lord. But you won't do it. Because that means you'd have to give up all these things that you're doing. You'd have to stop acting like the nations to return to the Lord. They won't do it. Verse 11. So, Ephraim has become like a silly dove without sense. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. When they go, I'll spread my net over them. I'll bring them down like the birds of the sky. I'll chastise them in accordance with the proclamation to their assembly. When your rulers go and tell the assembly, we know we're in trouble, but it's okay. We're going to go get help over here. We're going to Assyria. He says, you speak better than you know. It's kind of like in the New Testament, Caiaphas, okay, when you come into the Gospel of John, John 11, Caiaphas is the high priest that year. And he says, look, guys, when they're discussing, what are we going to do with Jesus? You know, he's raising folks from the dead. If it keeps going on like this, everybody's going to believe in him. He says, look, it's better for one man to die for the people than for the whole nation to perish. And then John gives that little aside and basically says, he spoke better than he knew. He didn't mean to prophesy, but he was sitting in the high priest's spot that year, and he gave a prophecy. He was prophesying that Jesus was going to die for the nation. He spoke better than he knew. In the same way, the leaders are saying, look, we're going to Assyria, and they're thinking for help. But Hosea is saying, yeah, you're going to Assyria, all right, but it's going to be a one-way trip. When you fly over there, the Lord's going to spread a net over you, and you ain't coming back. You're going to Assyria. You will go, you call out to Egypt, the bondage of Egypt. You're going back to the nations for help when you should be turning to the Lord to help you. Because the Lord's the one that healed you in the first place. He's the only one who can remedy your situation. Chapter 8, verse 1. So, put the trumpet in your lips. Like an eagle, the enemy comes against the house of the Lord, because they've transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. They cry out to me, my God, we of Israel know you. Verse 4, well, they've set up kings, but not by me. They appointed princes, but I didn't know it. With their silver and gold, they've made for themselves idols, that they might be cut off. So he's going to say later on in chapter 9, verse 7, you say you know me. I didn't know this was going on. So Israel, you should know this. The days of punishment are coming. The days of retribution have come. Let Israel know. The prophet's a fool. The inspired man is demented because of the grossness of y'all's iniquity and because your hostility is so great. It's coming. Get ready. He's going to say in chapter 8, verse 5, the Lord's rejected your calf, O Samaria, saying, my anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? For from Israel is even this, a craftsman made it, so it's not God. Surely the calf of Samaria will be broken into pieces. For they sowed the wind, and they reaped the whirlwind. The standing grain has no heads, it yields no grain. Should it yield, strangers would swallow it up. He says, you know what, Israel? You reap what you sow. You can't get around it. Okay? What you've been putting into this is what you're going to get right back out of it. You can't break the chain. The Lord has established this moral order, and you're going to be on the receiving end of it. Now, what has Israel been sowing? What have they been doing that's about to come right back at them? What have they been working at? They're supposed to be going to the Lord. They have it. What have they been doing? Chapter 5, verse 13 says, when Ephraim saw his sickness, when he saw his wound, when Judah saw his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to King Jerob. But he's unable to heal you or cure you from your wound. In chapter 7, verse 11, Ephraim's become like a silly dove without sense. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. Chapter 8, verse 9. They've gone to Assyria like a wild donkey all alone. Ephraim has hired lovers, and they hire allies among the nations. Chapter 12, verse 1. Ephraim feeds on wind and pursues the east wind continually. He multiplies lies and violence. Moreover, he makes a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. They're sowing to the wind. They're going to Assyria for help. And now they're going to reap the whirlwind. Assyria is coming right back at them. He says, you think these guys are going to help you? They're going to carry you away. These folks that you've been trusting in this whole time are going to be the very thing that comes and wipes you out. The ones that you're looking to for help. The whirlwind is going to be Assyria. So, chapter 9, verse 3, they will not remain in the Lord's land. Ephraim will return to Egypt, and in Assyria they will eat unclean food. Or chapter 10, verse 5, The inhabitants of Samaria will fear for the calf of Beth-Aven, that's Bethel. Indeed, its people will mourn for it, and its idolatrous priests will cry over it, over its glory since it's departed from it. The thing itself will be carried to Assyria as tribute to King Jerob. Ephraim will be seized with shame, and Israel will be ashamed of its own counsel. What counsel? The counsel to go to Assyria for help. You'll be ashamed. Why? Because Assyria is going to come, all right. They're going to help you right out of your land. They're going to help that idol of yours right off the altar, and they're going to carry it back as tribute. You're sowing to the wind. Whirlwind's coming. Get ready. So, if their problem is that they're sowing to the wind, if the problem is that they are storing up wrath by rejecting God and turning to the nations, what's the solution? What should they do? What is the remedy for their problem? That's right. Repent, return. Chapter 10, verse 12. Sow with a view to righteousness. Reap in accordance with Kesed. Break up your fallow ground, for it's time to seek the Lord until He comes to rain righteousness on you. That was chapter 6, verse 3. Remember? Come, let us return to the Lord. Verse 1, He's torn us, He'll heal us, He wounded us, He'll bandage us. So let us press on to know the Lord. His going forth is as certain as the dawn. He'll come to us like rain. Like the spring rain watering the earth. It's time to seek. If we seek, His going forth is as certain as the dawn. He's going to rain down His chesed on us. He will restore us. He will heal us. So let's return to Him, because this is His character. He doesn't change. He can't change. He is the God of loyal love. He will show compassion to us if we just seek Him. So return. Turn to Him. Do what is right. Seek His chesed. But as it stands, chapter 10, verse 13, y'all have plowed wickedness. You've reaped injustice. You've eaten the fruit of lies because you've trusted in your own way, in your numerous warriors. Therefore, a tumult will arise against your people, and all your fortresses will be destroyed. Verse 15. Thus it will be done to you at Bethel because of your great wickedness. At dawn, the king of Israel will be completely cut off. See, the Lord's going forth is as certain as the dawn. The question is, what team are you going to be when He comes? Are you seeking Him in His chesed? Or are you plowing wickedness over here? Well, you're plowing wickedness. So when He comes, His going forth that is certain as the dawn, at dawn, the king of Israel will be completely cut off. When He comes, it's judgment time. So Israel has a grim future ahead. That's what's going on. Remember the book of Isaiah? He's speaking to them for over a period of like 30 years. Okay, over time He's coming. He says, all right guys, this is not good. You need to change. You need to turn. You need to return to the Lord. Not doing it. Okay guys, you need to know that Assyria can't help you. Assyria can't fix this problem. You're going to go that way anyway. That's a problem. Okay guys, no. The judgment is right at the gate. You can't see it. It's right behind you. Behind you, Benjamin, we mentioned previous weeks how God is using the issue that was going on in the book of Judges with the rebellion of Benjamin, who was ultimately judged by his brother by getting behind him and setting an ambush. Well, Israel, think about Israel. The problem always comes from the north because if you're going east, it's a big desert. And if you go west, it's the sea. And south is Judah, and then Egypt will come from the south. But if you're anybody else, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, there's only one way through. Nobody's going to send an army through a desert. You come from the north. So Israel's over here looking at his brother. He says, you need to watch your back. You need to watch your back. It's your allies that are coming for you. It's Assyria. They're going to take you away. Now I look at this and I ask, well, what about us? We're not Israel. We are not a theocratic nation. I mean, the United States is not God's special people. We don't have a special covenant with the Lord. So when I look at a text such as this, what can I learn about us and our ways and our relationship to Him and God and His ways, His character? I think about this principle. You reap what you sow. I think on the one hand, the scandal of Christianity is that unlike the pagan expectation of karma, which is really every other religion, you know, you get out what you put in. If you do good things, you get good things back. Christianity says you don't get what you deserve because somebody else got what they didn't deserve. They got what you deserved, so now you can get what he has coming to him. That's Christianity. It's because the Son came in sacrificial mercy and stood in our place, now we who should be expecting the judgment are instead, we're reaping life. So there's the scandal there. But at the same time, I also think of the words of Paul in a book we've already covered, Galatians. You might recall this. This was the punchline at the end of Galatians. This is Galatians chapter 6. He's writing to believers. He's writing to a church. And he says this in Galatians 6, verse 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption, but the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. Let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we will reap if we do not grow weary. So then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, and especially to those who are of the household of the faith. God's not mocked. You know, you're making the bed, you're going to lie in it. You're sowing, you're going to reap. Not something like it, the very thing. Our problem is our temporality, especially for the believer. We've spoken of this many times, the fact that we live in a world that is topsy-turvy in many ways. Righteousness is punished, all right? The wicked seem to run away with things. You know, you go through the biblical history, and time and again, whether it's the prophets, or if you're going to look at Jesus, or if you're going to look at the apostles, they're getting killed. They're getting mocked, mistreated, spat upon, abused. We're saying they're not getting what they deserve. But the biblical testimony is, just wait. Just wait. He says, don't be confused because you can't see it now that it's not going to get restored. God is a God of justice. Justice is order. And at the end of the day, when the dawn comes, when he appears, he's going to fix it. So Paul will say, do not lose heart in doing good. For in time we will reap if we do not grow weary. The problem with the Galatians, the sowing to the flesh, they're doing the same thing that we see Israel doing in the Old Testament in Hosea. It's religiosity. It is spirituality. Remember, they're trying to get them to do these outward signs like circumcise. Follow the law, and that's what God really wants. That'll make him happy. It's not that. It's imputed righteousness or nothing. And if you've received, that's walking by the Spirit. It's by faith. It's completely given by God at his cost for your benefit. If you're living in that, it frees you up then to love your brother as yourself. Paul says, if you're doing that and you don't grow weary, believe it, you will reap in time.